join me now in extending a warm welcome to Phyllis from Newport News.
From Yorktown.
Hi, my name is Phyllis, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Phyllis.
Thank you for asking, you know, for allowing me to come. And I start off with just the beginning of how I grew up, which was the results of where I ended up. I grew up with parents that were uneducated. We were very poor. We lived in a project. And my father worked nights, and so I never saw him at night. He was really an absentee father. When he was there on weekends, he sat in his chair, read his paper, and he didn't say anything else. My mother's job seemed to be, you know, what it was supposed to be, and she was the yeller. So, but that's what he was. And the one thing, the worst things that I remember from him, I don't remember anything good. One was that once I was young, I was only in high school, and some boy gave me a really pretty necklace. And my father told me I had to return it because it was too good. And the other thing I remember with him was I got dressed for a prom, and my mother made the dress. I came out of the bedroom. My mother said, "How does your daughter look?" And he put his newspaper down, looked at me, and then picked up his newspaper. And that was what my father did. So he really, all the therapy I had, and they always asked me if I had, an absentee, what do they call it, a father, when he's not there, you know, when they leave you. I said no, because my father lived there. But I really didn't have one. And it took me a long time in this program to really realize that I really didn't grow up with one. I don't remember ever sitting on his lap, if he ever had me on his lap. My mother, on the other hand, was the most negative woman there was on the earth. There wasn't any positive thing that came out of her mouth. We used to say to her, if Jesus Christ came to dinner, you'd find fault with him, you know, because that's how bad she was. She had nothing good to say about me. Something was always wrong, and memories of her was, when I was in high school, don't try out for cheerleading because you can't make it. Don't let the guy teach you how to drive because you can't learn. You're stupid. And then the worst was is when I had to tell my parents that I was pregnant. And my mother said, okay, you really did it now. Nobody will ever love you and marry you. And I never forgot that. And that played in my head for a long time in recovery. Because I didn't get married till I was 49. I had 7 years of recovery. It's just, you know, growing up in that environment, we are parts of our environment. We are who we, you know, where we come from, I believe. So I had a very hard time. I did get through grammar school, and high school. My mother would just go, I was in very small Catholic schools, so that my mother felt more in control of telling the nuns every year to just pass my daughter. You know, I know she's stupid, she can't pass the test. You know, I couldn't pass tests, I couldn't do things. I mean, I just was so frightened in school of these nuns, you know, that I couldn't learn. And so she told me, just pass her, you know, and let her go. And we'll take care of her when she's 16 and 17. And that's what she said. So she never She always said I shouldn't do something because I can't do it. So I never tried to do anything in my life. I never tried to do anything. I just heard the tape, and the tape said that I couldn't do it. So I believed it. And but I always knew that there was something wrong with me, so I went to therapy very early as a child. I found my own way, always found somebody to see and to talk to. And one therapist had told me that you need to get away from your mother, otherwise you'll never have a life. And I never thought about it until after I was pregnant and years later that I really believed that I got pregnant in order to leave, because that was the first decision I ever made in my life, was to go away, have the baby, and give him up for adoption, because I didn't want my mother to take care of that baby. She didn't do such a great job with me, and I didn't want her to. So that was my upbringing. And, you know, then once I got out of high school was fun. I mean, I was with the boys all the time. They acknowledged me. I was a flirt, you know. I mean, I did try out for cheerleading, and I did make it, but then there was only 12 girls, you know, so they had to pick me, you know. But anyway, there was 12 girls in a class of and we had, like, the rest were all boys in our class. We graduated with 66 kids, and there was 12 girls. And so I had a ball, you know. That's where I learned to drink with them. Did I leave my water back there? Oh, I shouldn't. So that's where I started to drink, because I gravitated to the people that were in school that weren't the, you know, ones that were studying. They were in school. I went with the ones that after school, they went to the little candy store or whatever, hung out, and then when somebody's parents weren't home or something like that, we'd have a party and they'd have beer and stuff like that. So I went in with that crowd. And so it was fun. I did drink, I did black out. You know, I don't know how many times, because I blacked out. You know, so I just, you know, woke up, and everybody told me what I did, so I figured, well, that's okay, you know. But anyway, so once high school was over, though, that's when my drinking took off, because then I started to, we had fake IDs and stuff, we started to go to the bars, and now we were with the men, and that was when drugs came in. Because I was the type of person that I did whatever the man asked me to do. I was whatever he wanted me to be. That's who I was. I had no identity of my own. I didn't know anything. I didn't even know what music I liked or movies I liked or anything. I just used to go when people went, wherever they were going. I'll go see that movie. I'll go do this. I'll go do that. So I was just one of those people that, because I never was taught to think for myself. I never was taught anything, so I really didn't. Like I said, I wasn't able to make any decisions. They sent me to this school, you know, for hairdressing, and then they sent me here for, then I quit, and then I just went and did waitressing and stuff. They didn't ask me if I wanted to go to college because they figured I couldn't do it. But I was very blessed. God allows bad things to happen to people, but he always, like a father, makes good come from it. And going away and having that baby and giving him up and being all by myself, I was brought home by a couple that adopted children. I had called for Catholic Charities to help me because I had nowhere to go afterwards. And they picked me up, and I always wanted to be a nurse, but my mother told me I couldn't, so she was studying nursing. And I used to sit with her and everything, and I was supposed to only be there for 6 weeks, but after 6 weeks, they didn't want me to leave. They told me to stay because I didn't have any money to get a place to live or anything like that, so you should stay. And so I did, and then they asked me to stay again after I don't know how many months. And her husband said to me, you know, we have a community college here, and we want you to go and sign up and take the course. And you're not matriculating or anything like that. You're just using our address and taking this course. And I ended up getting an A. And so he said, take another course. And take another course. And I kept getting either high B's or A's. And so they finally said that, you know, take the sciences and then you can apply to get into the nursing school, because if you have the grades and stuff like that, there's a lot of people that want to get in. You'll get in, and I did. And but there again was when I graduated. It took me 10 years to get 4 years of college because I have ADHD, and I used to have to tape the lectures and go home and try to do the notes and stuff. But I did it because God gave me the gift of perseverance. And I went to, like, I think it was 18 summer sessions and 9 of the 2 ones. It was a long time. But and when I graduated, I didn't go to graduation because my parents or my brother, nobody told me that I was doing something great. So I figured I didn't do anything great, I shouldn't go. And so, but when I went to get my diploma, when I got called to come and get it in the office, I sat there and I looked at it, and then I started to cry. And then the thing that I did was the thing that I always did, was I took it to my parents. And my mother said, so now what can you do? And my father said, when are we eating? And that was it. So I learned when I went to Al-Anon, and it even says it in our literature, that you don't go to the hardware store for milk. And that's what I used to do all the time. I used to go home, try to tell them something I did that was, you know, good, that they would say something nice, but they never did. And when I came into the rooms, I had to literally, my sponsor had me stop going to see them, because every time I would go to visit, I would cry all the way home. I was living in Westchester at the time, and they were in Jersey, and I would just cry. And so she told me, I don't want you going anymore until you're strong enough and have some of this program under your belt that you can go and not come back crying, because you're gonna know that you're a better person than she thinks you are, you know? So that's what I had to do, not go for holidays or anything like that. And of course they didn't care, you know? I mean, that's why I stopped going on holidays, because I would go and they would make my holiday miserable, and they wouldn't have a good holiday either, because they never had anything happen that was good. They just weren't those kind of people. And my brother left and moved out a long time before me, and he was living in Florida, so he just went and took his kids and everything far away. So that was, you know, there. And once, after I had that baby, before that, it was the men were the things that got me into trouble, you know, because I would do anything they wanted. And after a while, I started to really feel, you know, like the street girl, you know, just that I wasn't getting paid, you know. And I grew up with morals coming in from out of a Catholic school, and I didn't have anything left. I felt like I was in the sewer. I wasn't in the gutter. I was really down in the sewer. And there was no way I was going to ever get out. And God would never, ever take me back. And that's what I believed. And I was 40 then. And I just didn't want to live anymore. and I was ready to kill myself. I graduated nursing. I had tried it one time when I was just an aide, and I used the wrong insulin. I used the short-acting insulin instead of the long-acting. So I didn't graduate nursing school yet. But I knew this time I was going to do it. I had it all planned. And for some reason, though, God had a plan for me, because I picked up the phone and I called this number. I don't even know how I got this number. I just found it and I called it, and it happened to be an outpatient drug place. And they told me, you know, do we need to put you in the hospital now? And I said, no, it's okay, because I never wanted to go to hospital, so I would always, you know, I wouldn't go. But I showed up the next morning like they asked me to, and I made the decision. It was hard. They told me I had to bring in the needles and the insulin, and I had to not drink or drug, and I had to see a psychiatrist. And psychiatrists didn't bother me because I saw a lot of them. So, you know, anyway, I saw him, and I went home, and they said, you have to decide whether you can do those three things, otherwise you can't come in. And so the hardest thing for me to do was to get rid of the drugs that I had, the insulin and the drugs that I had, because I just always wanted to have an ace in the hole, you know, if I needed it. But I went, because evidently I didn't want to die. And so I went. And the first thing, you know, the counselor said to me is, I think you need to go to AA meetings. And I said, well, I don't think alcohol is my problem, you know. Now, I used to, every month, go to a retail alcohol place and buy a gallon of gin, vodka, scotch, and rye. Every month. Lived alone. And I said it was for company, but I never had any, you know. Because at that time, I mean, basically, it was drugs they would bring rather than any alcohol. But I had to have my alcohol besides any of the drugs. But that's why then, too, we became dealers, and that was a really bad deal. I should have gotten arrested when we went to Puerto Rico. I went through security, and I carried up all the drugs on me like an idiot. My girlfriend's just, you know, walking through with like a hippie, and because that was the time, the age it was in. We had bells on around her ankles and stuff. But anyway, I was all dressed up, and so I was one. But we were only there one night, met guys in the bar, brought three of them back to the hotel room, and the next thing I know, I heard my friend in the morning calling up the desk downstairs, telling them to bring our mattress up because it fell over the railing, five stories down. And it was my bed, you know, because I was trying to pull it out there with this guy because I thought it would be nice to sleep under the stars, you know. And but I said, what are you, crazy? You're not ordering breakfast, you know. But just next thing we knew, knocking on the door, these men came in, and the three guys were Spanish, speaking Spanish. They kicked them. One was sleeping in the tub, one was somewhere else. They kicked them awake, and they were talking to them, and then the other guy was talking to both of us, and we had our story straight, but we didn't know what they were telling them. So it happened. So the next thing we know, we had to go down to see the manager, and the manager said, you know, 80 days for the mattress, 30 days in jail, and we said no. So the guys were really nice. They paid for the mattress. And we had to get out that day, you know. So we were in the hotel one night. And Anyway, and so we packed up and we went to the hotel next door, and and you know, it was my first trip. My brother did work for a travel agency, and so he booked everything, and that's why we got the balcony. The guy said, "You must know somebody. We got a balcony room." So anyway, so I didn't want to tell my brother that we got thrown out, you know, because they knew him and stuff. So I didn't say anything. But that night in the other hotel, we went out, bars. We ended up meeting the manager of the hotel we moved to. And I said, you know, we have vouchers. We don't have money. We have vouchers. So can we stay here? You take the vouchers so we can stay here, you know? And he said, well, I think you have to go down and see, you know, the head one, you know, and find out whether that's, I don't think it is. So we went for breakfast the next morning. She wanted to go to breakfast. So I said, no, I got to find out. Just wait, you know? And I find out, no, they don't take them. So I go running up there. I go running up to her and say, don't eat it, you know, because we don't have money to pay for it, you know. My brother had, you know, said we could just, you know, write on the ticket. He said, he told me, I finally had to call him because we didn't know what to do next. Because if we couldn't get somebody to take the voucher, then where would we stay? But my brother took care of it. He always saved me. He always pulled me out. So that was like one of the insane things that I knew I did, you know, when it came to believing I was insane, because I really didn't when I came in here. And I would not accept the fact that I was mentally ill. I was emotionally unstable. That was what I wanted to know. Because when I came into the rooms, when I did start to go to those meetings, for the first 90 days, I didn't say I was an alcoholic because I didn't believe I was. Because I didn't, you know, identify with these people that I was sitting around. I had always had a car. I always had a place to live. I had my bills paid. I always looked like I was together. I had four addictions that I was juggling, so I always looked like I was together. But in the end, it got too hard to keep all those plates up and still not let anybody know what was going on, except the landlord. I mean, because he would always see me coming home. You know, I'd always go out looking nice, but when I come back, the hairpiece, they used to wear hair pieces then, it would be over by my ear, you know, like an earmuff, and, you know, earring would be missing or whatever, you know. Eyelash, we used to wear the fake eyelashes then too, and one would be gone, and I'm going like this. And I always went out with the same guy, even though, you know, he was not, you know, the best of things, but I always kept them around until, you know, because I didn't want to look like I had too many guys come into the apartment, so I didn't want the landlord to think bad of me. So I would just keep them, you know, and then when I, you know, really had enough of that, then I would find somebody else, but I would make sure first that I had that person, because I didn't drive drunk. I always made sure somebody else did. So I was always with somebody that drove, you know, and because I never wanted to mark off yes on that test. So I didn't drink alone, you know. I would always, you know, one apartment I had, I always took the landlord's wife. You know, I'd come home and we'd be out having gin and tonics and stuff like that. And he said, you know, the husband says, you know, I go to the store and buy beer now, but now I have to buy my wife, you know, gin, you know. She never drank, you know. And I was like, well, you know, it's nice to have some company when I'm coming back from work, you know. So I didn't want to drink alone. I didn't want to drive drunk. When I went to parties, if I didn't have somebody that could drive me and I went, I used to bring my blow-up bed with my uniform for nursing to go to bed, you know, to go to work. And I always planned. This is why it was so hard. At the end, it was too hard. I worked too hard. I never had to call in sick or anything like that because I always would plan to have the next day off, you know. So I would plan it. So I didn't, you know, had time. And then after a while, I just went on 3 to 11 shift. So I had time to go out, and then I had time to get up in the morning, get my act together, and go to work. But of course, you know, I thought I was, you know, the best thing since sliced bread at work, but I ended up discovering that I wasn't. Because one time I had said, you know, I think I'm going to bring a book in and I'll write down the things that, you know, I keep saying we need to change. I was like a control freak, you know. I always knew what was the right thing to do and the best thing to do, and I got angry when people weren't doing it. And I used to, that was why I went around in the hospital. I went from one floor to the other. I floated because people couldn't work with me. Because if I get angry, I throw things. I just pick up whatever closest to me and I throw it. I have the rage like my father. It's the only time I ever heard him say anything, and it was always in Italian, so, but I knew he was cursing. So, I would throw something, and that's just what I did. And I would do it at work, and people didn't want to work with me. But I mean, I did it one time, a guy that we went out on a boat with them, with another couple and everything, and I got angry, and I picked up a shoe and I threw it in the water. It was the guy's shoe, you know? It went down. Now we're up New York State, got to go out to eat. He's not allowed in because he has no shoe, you know? So I said to the guy I was with, well, let's go in and eat and we'll bring him some food when we come out, you know? But anyway, but that's what I did. Another time I was at a wedding and I was mad because the guy wasn't paying enough attention to me. So I went and I sat at the bar and I was drinking, and then when I came, it was a long time, so then I went out to see what was going on. I saw him dancing with this other girl, and I just picked up the drink that was there, threw it, didn't hit him, hit her. So it just was not the best. But the worst was, the next day I went to work and I floated to this one floor. I heard these two nurses talking about this crazy lady at this wedding. And I was like, oh shit, it's me, you know? So now, all night, I'm trying to dodge them, you know, going up the other hall, they're down that hall, I'm going down this hall, you know, I was just trying to stay away from them. But that was me, you know, I just always got into trouble. And that was the kind of trouble I got into. Fortunately, I didn't get arrested because I knew I wouldn't do good in jail. I don't look good in orange. I don't like orange. And they don't allow you to have blow dryers and makeup, I heard. So I just said, I can't do it. You know, I just can't do it. I mean, so, but anyway. So I didn't say I was an alcoholic for 90 days. And after 90 days, a gentleman came up to me. I thought he was a wise ass, you know. He said to me, well, do you know yet whether you are? And I said, no, I'm not sure. And he says, well, when you come out of the meetings, how do you feel? And I said, well, I always feel better. It just doesn't last. So he said, well, when the medicine works, you have the disease. And because I was a nurse, that clicked for me. The allergy thing didn't work. I don't believe any of that, so, but that did, and so I did decide to stay. But I wasn't willing to get a sponsor yet, because I wasn't going to have another mother tell me what to do. So that was my thought process. But I eventually was in enough pain, and I asked for help. I always have to have my back against the wall in order to do it. That's just my nature. Well, because being a nurse, you know, was hard. I was saving lives. What do I have to be here for? I can save lives, you know. I just couldn't save mine, you know. But, so, anyway. Okay, that's where I took the Calgon bath. What was I talking about? Just takes me away, you know what I mean? Where I was. What was I talking about? Or should I just go on to the next thing if I could think of something? But anyway. So anyway, I did finally get the sponsor. And I knew I was gonna have to do some things. I wasn't gonna do a lot of things. I wouldn't get a book. I wouldn't get a 12 and 12, and the big book was just too big for me. I wasn't a reader because I had ADHD and it was too hard. It took me a year to read one book. you know. So I wasn't about to read the books and everything, so I, but she did tell me what I had to do, because I didn't want to read the book yet. And she said, well, you have to call me every morning at 9 o'clock. You have to write 3 things of gratitude, and then you have to let me know what meeting you're going to. I don't care what meeting it is, but you go to a meeting every day, and you tell me which one. So that was hard. About the first 2-3 weeks, I was nauseous in the morning. It was so frightening to pick up the phone and call a stranger, you know, and talk. You would think I would have a hard time, you know, talking, because I'm talking so much now, but I had a hard time talking. So I had to do that. And after that, and we were working together and everything like that, then she told me, you know, she wanted me to work with the steps, and I still wasn't willing to do that, you know, to read them and stuff. So she basically had me working the steps without me knowing it. Like, in order to get the we of that first step, she wanted me to call 2 other women every day. So I did, because now I was used to calling her, and I got these numbers. I used to just, but I called them when they weren't, when I knew they were working. Because at that time, they had answering machines. They didn't have cell phones, so I call them when they're working. So, but she told me, if the people aren't there, make sure you leave a message. Tell them, you know, who you are, and give them your number, and tell them why you're calling. And if you're really bad and everything, you just say, you know, you want a drink, or you're really struggling or whatever. So they call you back, because I didn't really realize how much, when people do sponsor a lot of people and stuff like that, they get a lot of phone calls and stuff like that, and they don't have the time. So and my sponsor was good in teaching me to not put her on a pedestal. Because when she go on vacation, she would tell me I had to, a month before, I would have to get somebody else that I was going to call every day. And so, because it wasn't going to be her. And then one time I called her, and she was working, and I was really crying and everything, and she said, I'm working and I can't. Because she told me that's why I had to learn to call people. She wanted me to have at least 4 to 5 women that I could call, because she wasn't always going to be available. And that was the best thing I did learn, because it even helped me when I started sponsoring, that, you know, that I can go away, I don't have to, you know, be responsible, you know, to answer the phone if, you know, because if it's really, you know, necessary and stuff like that, you know, you want to do it, you know, you want to help them. So, but, so I got to that, but she took me through. I used basically the whole first year. She gave me all the slogans. That's what I lived on, you know. Let go and let God, you know. Live and let live. Keep it simple. Easy does it. First things first. The best was, is, you know, up north in New York area, they had the Think sign upside down. It was upside down. And of course, everybody goes in and turns it right side up because they think they made a mistake. But then the person who's chairing the meeting goes and fixes it and says, you know, it goes down. And somebody says, why? Because you don't have anything to think with. You have upside down thinking, and so you don't think. They used to tell you, don't drink. Go to meetings and don't, you know, think, you know, just because you. And then one guy said to his sponsor, you're telling me I can't think? And he says, yeah, well, look at where your thinking got you. You have nothing to think with, you know? Even his dog left him, he said, you know? So, you know, it was that kind of thing. And after a while, you know, it makes a lot of sense to me. Because even today, after having the time that I have, my first thought can be wrong. Still, because, you know, my thinking was totally, I never lived in reality, didn't know that. I really didn't know that I wasn't living in reality, that I was really delusional. I didn't like those words at all. One time my husband called me delusional, and I was going to a meeting that morning, and wouldn't you know, the guy was had a topic of delusion, you know. When it came around to me, I said, I'm not saying anything to you. I'm pissed, you know. My husband just told me that, and I don't want to hear it again, you know. So don't tell me I'm delusional. But after a while, when you stay long enough, and I did go through the steps in doing 1, 2, and 3, I realized, you know, and in 4, you know, I realized really how insane I was. But the hardest part for me in step 1 was the we of that step. The unmanageability I got quick, because even though I wasn't drinking or drugging, my life was unmanageable. I was struggling, so I knew it was unmanageable. I mean, I didn't think so when I was drinking. I thought it was perfect. But and then the powerlessness, it wasn't so much being powerless over the alcohol, because a lot of times I could just leave that because I had another out, you know, another thing to use to take away the anxiety and stuff, and just to feel good. That was the tool that I used in the toolbox, was the hammer. That was the only one I knew how to use on everything. So I really had to, she had me go to people, places, and situations, because that's what used to really piss me off, because I wanted everybody to do what I wanted. That second part of the serenity prayer, where, you know, you're the director and everything, that was me. The first part of that, you know, I mean, I wanted to say when I used to do the serenity prayer, you know, when it says, you know, to have the be able to know what you can change, you know. And of course, you know, I was like, I could change everything, you know, I have to at least try, you know. So I just couldn't get that. I couldn't get that thing until I heard somebody say, the short version is God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change and to change the things I can. And that's me. And that brings it right to my face. And so that's what I ended up learning to say. And a lot of the sayings that they told me in the beginning was what kept me coming, you know. It kept me holding on to my seat, and some days I was hanging, some days hanging lower than you would wanna, but because I had to be dragged a lot of times, I loved when the thing that caught me was when I went to a speaker meeting, somebody said, you know, they tell you to keep coming back, they'll love you until you could love yourself. And I hated myself so much that I didn't think it was possible for me to even like myself after everything I did. That stuck with me. And then of course, you know, always saying keep coming back and hang on to your chair, you know, your seat. Those things, that's what, like, the slogans and those things. Already? Oh my goodness. Oh, okay. So I did my 1, 2, and 3. I did do my 1, 2, 3. I did do the 4th step. I learned a lot in that 4th step, how insane I, you know, that I didn't live in reality and stuff. And I learned with the rest of the steps, 6 and 7, 8 and 9, you know, what really made me a better person, you know, the person that I was created to be. I mean, in the end, it was just like what they told me, you'll have a life beyond your wildest dreams. I never believed it, but it happened. And as a result of doing the steps, and the spirituality, you know, grew. When I moved here to Virginia, just took off. You know, you get your physical and emotional self settled. You have to get rid of all the garbage in order to have the good stuff in. God can't give you good stuff if you're full with garbage. So you have to get rid of that. And It was hard. It was hard to, a lot of the character defects, but my sponsor there too, you know, had me practice them. I had to write. She taught me how to journal. You know, she really taught me the tools. And today I know the most valuable tool is the journaling and sponsoring, giving it back, service. Those are the two things that give me long-term recovery. It'll be 34 years in May, and for a person who didn't want to be here, I'm here, and that's amazing. But today, I've learned to respect people. I've learned to accept their opinion. I've learned to correct myself and say when I'm wrong and apologize, which was really a tough one. And I just learned, well, I used to be really cheap. I became very charitable. I buy nice presents today for people. I was always, I thought I was frugal. That was the word I used for myself when I came in. That was an asset to be frugal, but no, I was cheap. I learned that. Outright cheap. But now I can go to a store and I don't think of how much I'm going to spend, and you know, I just look for something that I think the person would really like or could use, and I buy it. And that's very different for me. And I'm able to forgive me. I was able to forgive myself, and that was for step 8. I couldn't forgive anybody else until I forgave myself. And it took me a long time because I just thought, you know, there was no way God could forgive me for the life that I led. And but I did. I did. Like I say, if you just keep coming, if you just keep coming and do the best you can every day, God just wants you to try. He doesn't care if you succeed or you don't. Just try. And that was a hard word for me to use, to learn, because my mother told me not to try anything, because I couldn't. So it was hard for me to try. But today I know that that's all God wants from me. And today I'm the woman that He wanted me to be. And I continue to, I think, grow spiritually in a sense because of the sponsorship. You know, going through those steps over and over again with somebody and giving back what was so freely given to me. You know, gift of, you know, you always said, you know, getting sober was the greatest gift that you could get. But for me, it's sponsoring now is a greater gift, giving it back. And I just really, you know, feel like that was, you know, a calling for me. And that was the other thing I loved that kept me. And how it works, it always says your primary purpose is to help another alcoholic. And I never had a purpose to live. I never had a purpose. I always just say God left me out. I have no talents. I have no gifts, you know, to be anything. And so I was at the end of the line. But I do today. And the God of my understanding. I didn't go to the God that I believed in when I was young, Catholic school. But after my fourth step, sharing it with my sponsor, the thing that I was most afraid of to tell, because I never told any of the therapists I ever went to, that I had the baby and gave him up. And I did that. I put everything down like they said. And she did the same thing. And at that moment, I knew that God put her in my life. And that's when I started to have a God. I was able to write a letter. She wanted me to write a letter with the fourth step as, you know, what would I like my God to be? And for me, it was my father, a father I never had. You know, because he makes good come from the bad stuff when I make mistakes. He makes good stuff come from it. And that's what a parent does. When a child falls, you make it better. And that's what he does. And no matter what, he loves you unconditionally. So today I am married, and I have someone that loves me unconditionally in spite of my craziness. It's a life beyond my wildest dreams. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.
Quick.
There you go.
Oh, upside down.